to you from the Forge of Freedom studio in the heart of America, a podcast dedicated to preserving freedom and inspiring personal success. Freedom is born and lives through you, the individual, and it dies in the shadows of tyranny. Motivating our listeners to become well-rounded, freedom-minded people with the body of an athlete, the mind of a stoic, and the spirit of a warrior. The Tree of Liberty lives on through you, the Forge of Freedom. And now here's your host, Alex Uli.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Forge of Freedom podcast. I'm your host, Alex Uli, and this is episode 29 of the Forge of Freedom. Today, we're going to discuss a book that had a profound influence on me as a child, and the lessons that I learned from the book stuck with me through school and into adulthood. And the book I'm referring to is The Adventures of Jonathan Gullible, A Free Market Odyssey by Ken Skuland. And to discuss the book, I'm joined by two special guests. First, Aaron Sperling. If you've been watching the video version of the podcast, you might recognize Aaron from episode 13 of the Forge of Freedom on Stoic philosophy. Aaron, like me, is an attorney, and among other things, he writes the Indiana Jury Verdict Reporter. But Aaron's true passion is philosophy and logic. And Aaron is the one who gifted me The Adventures of Jonathan Gullible so many years ago when I was, I believe, 8 or 9 years old. So welcome to the show, Aaron. And our other guest with us today is none other than Ken Skuland himself, the author of The Adventures of Jonathan Gullible, A Free Market Odyssey. Welcome to the show, Mr. Skuland.
Thank you very much, Alex. I really appreciate being here. It's really fun to connect up.
Yeah. It's a book I've told many people about and the influence that it had on me. And Aaron has gifted me quite a few books over the years from Rothbard and Mises and Hayek. But this one I remember, I think, the most, because I think it was the first one and also the book that sort of opened my mind to these sorts of free market and libertarian ideas. So this one is of particular importance to me. And I think... Aaron, it looks like we're having a little technical issue with your end there. If you don't mind, it says to refresh your page. Sorry for the interruption. That's okay. And while you're doing that, I'll keep chatting. This book had a particularly important and profound influence on me, and sort of, I don't think I would have gotten interested in Mises or Hayek or Rothbard if not for having read your book. And so I just want to take a little bit of time here at the beginning, I think, to give you the floor and tell folks a little bit about yourself and about the book.
Okay. Shall I go? Yeah.
Yeah. Go
okay,
ahead.
Great.
The floor is yours.
Yeah, well, let me just state for a little bit of background, I'm a professor of economics at Hawaii Pacific University, but most of my fun has been generated by libertarian activities around the world. I'm fortunate that to have a family that joins me in all of these pursuits. My wife is from China, experienced the worst of the Cultural Revolution, and is real hardcore libertarian at heart. And my daughter, having grown up in a libertarian household, she's also quite the activist as well. The three of us have traveled the world for many years now doing conferences. I with Liberty International, that is now holding their 37th conference in Madrid, but it's an international group to try and promote free market ideas around the world. My wife has organized more than 10 years of conferences in China, first at Northeastern University and then touring around China. And then my daughter, too, she's been very active at in camps with youth all around the world. And this story is about the book, The Adventures of Jonathan Gullible, which I'm pleased to say now is published in more than 90 editions in 57 languages with five plays on all the continents and numerous audiobooks and other animation that has been produced of the philosophy of liberty that's derived from the book. And it starts off as a story on the island of Corumpo, which is Latin for corruption, in the manner of Gulliver's Travels, of the young boy who's caught up in a storm and his boat is tossed about, and he winds up stranded on this island where he experiences all the strange things. And in much the manner of the Little Prince and in Gulliver's Travels, he just simply asks questions about how things are done there. And people reveal the folly of governmental policy just by their responses and answers to his questions, first in the island and then in the city of Stulta, which is derived from ideas by Friedrich Bastiat. He had allegories about Stulta and Pera, two cities that were rivals in trade competition. And later it was pointed out to me that that's the Latin for silly girl. Then what this book does is try to introduce ideas about freedom through humor. Actually, that's what I found was so effective about Milton Friedman's approach to economics. He had such a great sense of humor. And my favorite economist of all is the 19th century French economist. They didn't really officially have terms of economist at all, but he was the one who wrote such effective ideas about philosophy and economics. That was Friedrich Bastiat. And you see it all around you. One of my favorite books is the book Hammer and Tickle, that tells about all the jokes that brought down the Soviet Union. I mean, because that was the thing that tyrants feared the most, was to be laughed at. And they sent off, Stalin would send people off to the gulag for 15 years for telling a joke, 10 years for laughing at the joke, 5 years for not reporting the joke. I mean, they were panicked about the idea that people would laugh at them. And of course, that's because laughter and satire is the greatest way to undermine the power and authority of tyrants. So the book itself has started to emerge in lots of different ways. It started off as radio commentary. I was asked to write some commentaries for the an all-news business radio station in Honolulu. I was asked by the Libertarian Party of Hawaii to be a weekly commentator. I was an economist, and they thought, well, I could come in on the weekly issues. But I found that people weren't responding much to straight commentary from an economist, so I engaged this this dialogue style of a story that I called The Adventures of Jonathan Gullible. And actually, there was a tremendous response that picked up all around town. A lot of people got the message. They laughed at the scenarios that pointed out indirectly what was going on, the folly of governmental policy, without preaching at them. And that was the thing. It got people thinking about things in humor and satire without preaching at them. And then I thought, well, this is a fantastic new way to approach economics. I had just I had read this Economist magazine that, the puzzling failure of economics. Now, what did they say was the puzzling failure of economics? One, it was so boring and drab that nobody ever paid much attention to these old dry and wrong textbooks. Not only were they boring, but they were wrong in their constant preaching, perpetually preaching about the necessity of government intervention. And I felt that that was exactly the wrong kind of thing. As L. Neil Smith would point out, the government is like a disease masquerading as its own cure. Always the problems that it creates, they create more government to try and solve those problems. So at any rate,
and in fact, you have a chapter in your book about the oldest profession in the world, about economists who sort of justify government power through their economic studies that, of course, always turn out to be wrong, and there's no repercussions for that having been wrong, except the expansion, perpetual expansion of government power.
Yeah, there's always more of a justification. Oh, we got to hire more economists then if the problem is getting worse.
Right.
And the approach is always through questions. You know, Jonathan always asks questions, just like the little prince in the story. I don't know if many people of your readers or listeners or have ever read that book, but to me, it made a real impact. This little prince goes from asteroid to asteroid, simply asking questions, and people pointed out such incredible folly by their practices. And the message wasn't by preaching and telling people what was right or wrong. It was pointing out how the obvious, how things were terribly wrong. And then each chapter in the book is followed up with questions, and not in every edition, but I've got several editions, the commentary edition, the youth edition, the university edition. But the commentary edition and the university edition have questions at the end, and they also have some extra information about background references. But it's always posing questions to the reader, and every chapter asks the question, what ethical issues are concerned? Are involved, because in every case there's the core the consideration of force. When is force justified? And I, as a libertarian, advocate the non-aggression principle, saying that if I don't have the right to initiate force or violence against another, then it's not right for me to ask others to do it for me, right? Whether they have government hats or just large numbers of people. And I'm also pleased that Jeanette Eldridge, pictured here in the lower left from South Africa, decided that we needed a commentary edition so that each chapter could be accompanied by background and references and extra explanation for anyone that might be an educator using the book. So we have those. And what we drive is the message in the book is from all of these economists, primarily Austrian economists in the contemporary context, but also throughout history. We have some that preceded the Austrian school of economics. The Austrian school is Ludwig von Mises and Friedrich Hayek, Murray Rothbard, most notably. But also I have a lot of other philosophers from history. I reference Lao Tzu, who's probably the oldest libertarian thousands of years ago in China, advocating the non-role for government, and François Canet in France, Adam Smith, John Locke, and many others that I reference in the book, because I am in a sense a second-hander on the ideas of great men and women who came before me, and so I put these together in a story in an enjoyable way to present the ideas of these great philosophers. And I've got, by the way, there's only Rose Friedman and Ayn Rand as women in there, but there, of course, were many more to reference. And the way they are related in the stories is in a fun and fanciful way. For example, in the upper left-hand column, we're talking about rent controls, and building codes and zoning laws. And those were all things that Milton Friedman addressed. But I do it in a story form that people are more likely to pick up on. And for Friedrich Bastiat, I talk about the impact of taxes, of the trade barriers. I mentioned to you before about Stolta and Puera. And so I talk about how the trade barriers are illustrated in this story as well. Henry Hazlitt, Julian Simon, David Friedman. I go on to Murray Rothbard, Walter Block, François Canet. Dostoevsky is featured in here in an element about why people willing to tolerate tyranny. Adam Smith, Ayn Rand, John Locke, Friedrich Hayek, and Ludwig von Mises. All of them have various stories related throughout. And these are some of the colorful illustrations in the youth edition. It makes it nicer for presentation, but I don't use illustrations in the university edition or the commentary edition. Now, let's take just Friedrich Bastiat as one simple example. He said, we've got Stolta and Puera. Stolta puts up trade barriers, meaning these boulders on the objects going into Stolta, and then should Puera then put obstacles on the other side of the road coming out of Stolta? And Friedrich Bastiat says, no, it's foolish to put the barriers on one side of the road, but it doesn't make it better to put barriers on the other side of the road. And he also likens that to a river. You know, if Stalta puts up barriers to objects going there, it's like a city is upstream where it's harder to get to. And presumably, if trade barriers were beneficial, you'd want the city on the mountaintop where it's extremely difficult to get to, but easy to send things out from. And he says that's folly. The cities that have built up, like Hong Kong throughout history, with unilateral free trade, are the cities where it's easiest to get to. It's downstream, where the current and the flow and the winds favor easy access, not obstacles to access. He also points this out in his story about the famous candle makers petition, where the candle makers and coat makers have decided to put up trade barriers against that free light and heat from the sun, because it's jeopardizing the jobs in their industries. And so people clamor for banning the sun. And I illustrate that in the story in the book, you know, by saying we're going to put a high window tax, which is a tariff on all that free light and heat from the sun in order to give more jobs to candle makers and coat makers. Well, everybody can see the folly of that when you think about it with regard to the sun. But that's exactly what trade barriers are all the time in all the other areas that people seem to accept, because they accept this protectionist logic that trade barriers are beneficial to a country as a whole. I also wrote The Philosophy of Liberty. This had an interesting origin. The first book didn't have The Philosophy of Liberty written out, you know, what the basis of the book is. But when the first international edition was done in the Netherlands, the second international edition was in Russia, right after the fall of the Soviet Union. It was probably the first free market book published in Russia. And the guy, Dmitry Kostigin, who's now, he was then a poor tour guide. Now he's a fabulously wealthy billionaire grocer in Russia, who's had some troubles with the police from time to time. Nevertheless, he was asking me, couldn't we put some kind of explanation to the Russian readers who know nothing about property and taxes? So initially I wrote this introduction to the book called The Philosophy of Liberty, which is, it became so popular, especially with an animation production that was produced of this. So I put it as the epilogue of every other edition of the book. And it explains the basic philosophy of liberty and the principles of self-ownership and the adverse effects of government interventions. And this has now been made into animation in 46 languages around the world. Now, it's all based on this philosophy that economic freedom is practical. When you have economic freedom, as is pointed out by the Fraser Institute, the real question isn't why is there poverty around the world? That's the natural state of things. What we're really curious about is why is there prosperity? Because every country has been developing differently in the last 100 or 200 years. Well, economic freedom is practical because it brings about a much more prosperous society, but it's also humanitarian. It diminishes the power of politicians and of authoritarians all around the world, gives greater abundance to people in society, and it's ethical. It's the way of treating people voluntarily instead of through control. Now, the Fraser Institute has what they call the Economic Freedom of the World Index, where they measure different kinds of controls over society, of the size of government spending, contracts and property rights, sound money, free trade, restrained regulatory controls. And they measure this in all the countries of the world that they have data on. They don't have for North Korea, but it's off the bottom of the chart, surely. And they show a very, very positive correlation that the countries that have the most economic freedom have the greatest amount of income per capita, they have the greatest life expectancy, greatest political and civil liberties, greatest advancements in gender equality, and the poorest to 10% of the population thrive the best. And also there's the least amount of corruption, where there's greater economic freedom and the much better environmental performance, because prosperous countries can cope with the environment more easily. And I lay it out on the economic spectrum of degrees of governmental control. The countries that are highly controlled are usually associated one way or another with a communist or authoritarian government, where the government owns everything. And then I have other schools of thought that I often present in my economics classes, about the Keynesian school, which says that fiscal policy can deal with everything, the monetarist policy, which argues that central banking is the way to control everything, but the Austrian school argues that the government should get out of the way in all of those areas. It is the problem, not the solution. So I show in this little slide here, not only the economists that represented these different schools of thought, but the sort of political followers that have taken up those ideas. Now, I mentioned you can see Milton Friedman here. He's over very close to the Austrians. He was never an Austrian, but I'd say that his son, David Friedman, gave him a strong push towards the end of his career. And I think he became more and more disenchanted with the likelihood that the Federal Reserve Board would even behave correctly. And so I think he was, I consider him a strong fellow traveler, and certainly one who had a very, very big influence on my life in developing my appreciation for economic freedom. The book has been picked up all around the world in multitude of languages. I'm very, very pleased with what's happening in Republic of Georgia right now. They have not only made the second translation of the book due to Nardar, who has now not only made it as a feature program in a monthly YouTube podcast, but also he's taking the new book around to all the schools and universities and high schools to teach economics, free market economics, in all the schools of the Republic of Georgia. So I'm really pleased at what he and the others in his team have been doing with the new economic school of Georgia. It's been very successful throughout Latin America in a multitude of editions in, three Spanish language editions and two Portuguese editions, and now a new play that's been produced in Portugal based on the book. It's been successful throughout Africa, and especially by the use of theater. People are not reading so much, but they do always enjoy theater. And a play was produced by Adedao Thomas and circulated, went to 5 universities in West Africa. It was also produced as a theater production in Kenya. Here's the cover on the lower right-hand corner of the production that was just produced in Brazil in Portuguese. It was made into a musical production for all the high schools in Slovakia, and also by a musical production for television and theater in the schools for elementary schools in Kazakhstan, which produced it both in Kazakh and Russian. So it's also been circulated through media in the Commonwealth of Independent States, which includes Russia. And very, very successful, not the whole book, but certain chapters that point out the folly of communism. And I'm pleased to say that we're now producing a cartoon version that's hopefully going to develop over a three seasons of featuring all the chapters in the book. And I'm pleased to say that it's won numerous awards and recognition for economics, for excellence in economics education. And lastly, I'd have to say that the important thing is that networking has been very, very critical in the development of this book over decades now. I mean, it hasn't been just a few people doing this. This has been the work of hundreds of people and more than 100 public policy institutes all around the planet that have taken an interest in Jonathan Gullible, either published it or helped promote it, and added to the spread of this idea very effectively. One of which was to publish put the book on a CD in the Ideas for a Free Society, which is a collection of all kinds of literature of liberty. There's lots of stuff that was produced all around history, and they added my book to that as well. And then circulated that in hundreds of thousands of editions that were spread to Well, I'd say that a lot of the poorer countries of the world that didn't have access to books and the internet. And of course, then we also used these CDs in China, where we introduced the CDs at our 10-year annual summer camps at Northeastern University. Made a breakthrough in a lot of very hard to crack cases in the world. Throughout the Middle East now, the book is widely circulated. It's not only available in Pakistan in three languages, but in India in three languages. We've had a Dari edition in Afghanistan before the fall of the government there and the takeover of the Taliban. But even then, they're expecting to be producing a Pashto edition as well for the second largest language in Afghanistan. So the idea is still spread electronically, even if the print editions are much more controlled. So it goes into magazines and audiobooks. You can find the audiobook on my website, thejonathangelable.com. The book itself is available in multiple editions, in the Kindle edition and commentary editions, I can't say enough about all the people who have contributed to these many, many projects. The Arabic edition came out just before Arab Spring, so I do take full credit for all of the positive changes that occurred during that period of time. But of course, there were a lot of negative things that happened as well. So that's the story. We're hoping to, I like to give recognition to Sam Sloan, who just passed away last week. And he's the one who was founder of Small Business Hawaii, who decided first to publish the book from what had been a radio version into publication. And then Flora Ling, who was the fantastic editor from Money Magazine, who really embellished the writing style of the book. So that pretty much leaves us to where we are. No, we have a readers group, an international readers group that meets now the first Saturday of every month. That'll be this Saturday, as a matter of fact, it connects through Facebook, and they have a kind of Zoom session where people from all over the world can come together and talk about a chapter and how it relates to their part of the world. Well, I guess that's brings us back to our discussion.
Yeah, excellent. Well, thank you for that presentation. And if you don't mind, just to say it, well, actually, I should say this first. For those of you who are listening by audio only, the presentation that Mr. Schoolin had presented here is, you can see it in the video version of the podcast, either on Spotify or on YouTube, Rumble, or Facebook. So if you were curious about what some of the slides showed and you didn't see that, you can find the video version of the podcast. So with that, Mr. Schoolin, if you don't mind, and I think we have Aaron back by audio, at least we had some technical difficulties with his connection. Aaron, are you there? Can you hear us now?
I am here. Can you hear me?
Excellent. Yes, we have you back.
Yeah, I apologize for that. I think maybe I'm in my basement, and so I think maybe I'm far enough away from my router that with the video, my connection was unstable, and so I've logged back in with just audio only. I apologize for that that technical glitch, but I'm back in spirit.
Good. Well, and the audio seems to be working perfectly well now, so
I'm good.
Glad to have you back.
Okay. I'm guessing that he must be the alpha male because he's A on there, and
the only time in my life anybody could consider me an alpha male, so I thank you for that. I appreciate it.
This is your time to shine, Aaron.
Yes, all of right. course.
Can you tell us a little bit? I know you said it got started with the radio show. The book was written in the 80s. Am I correct about that? And number one, and then if you don't mind, say a little bit about the motivation behind writing, or actually, I guess, starting the radio show and then behind writing the book, and sort of the context and the era in history in which it was written.
Sure. I was had been teaching in Alaska for 5 years and just moved to Hawaii in 1979. And I joined up with the Libertarian Party of Hawaii. Always a small group, but I'm, you know, very active. And they asked me to take over a spot that they had on the KHVH All News Business Radio station at the time and give libertarian commentary, representing the Libertarian Party of Hawaii. And so I started these commentaries, and they weren't, you know, people didn't pay too much attention to commentaries. I didn't get much feedback. And then I had a girlfriend at the time that I wanted to include in this, in these things. And I thought that the idea of a dialogue would be much more effective, as it was with The Little Prince and Gulliver's Travels. So I engaged her in this discussion back and forth. And by writing it, and it took me a long time to write these things. This is before the computers and word processing. I was writing out probably at least 8 drafts of any commentary before I would feel comfortable about it. And I only had 90 seconds, so that's why it had to be concise and had to weave in several times, making the point, had to have some sense of humor to give it reason to pay attention to it. So it was a well, concisely crafted piece of radio, and then it had to be dramatic. As you may recall, we last left Jonathan Gallible on a remote Pacific island after his boat was tossed about by a terrific storm one day. And yeah. So then the issue would start off, and there was a lot of comment that I got. A lot of people heard it. They liked it. They made good positive remarks. And so I thought, I'm really onto something there. And then I compiled all of these radio commentaries that I did into a little booklet like this. Each page was a different day's commentary. And since I had these, and Sam Sloan thought, and I did spend a little time back up in Alaska where I produced it as a show, a series in radio. And at any rate, Sam Sloan thought this was a pretty good idea. He wanted to make it available for all the high schools in Hawaii. So he had Small Business Hawaii publish the first edition of it. And the book, of course, wasn't ever received by the Department of Education. They kept having to review it. And I'm convinced that after the People's Republic of North Korea finally accepts this book, then finally the Department of Education in Hawaii will come around to accepting it.
Well, I think at some point, I don't know if it was an article or an interview that you did, somebody mentioned that you'd been able to get this book into Cuba under communist control, but you couldn't get it into the Department of Education in Hawaii.
It was published. It was approved by the mullahs in Iran in the Farsi edition. And still, the Department of Education in Hawaii hasn't given it approval.
Wow. So you were writing this book in the... I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I mean, it was the first free market book published in Vietnam, probably in China. I mean, in Russia, for sure. And published by the government of Russia. And people said, well, why did you have the government publish it in Russia? And I said, well, only the government is allowed to own a publishing company in Russia, in China, in Vietnam. And yet they wanted to make money. And they thought, well, maybe this will make money. So they were publishing and printing it. Actually, I had a student from Russia, and I said, you know, I'm not sure what's happening with the Russian edition now. A second edition was translated, but I asked him to do some research in Russia to find out if anyone's making it available. And he says, oh yeah, when I went online, I found it available on probably more than 20 sites where they were publishing it or printing it or offering it free one way or another throughout the whole of Russia. And of course, I knew nothing about it, but frankly, I'm delighted. That's the whole point of it. And if they're going to go ahead and use it, I don't care. I mean, I love it. I think that's great.
May I ask a question?
Oh, yeah, yeah, go for it, Aaron.
I want to intercede there. Do you have any idea whether or not, say, the Russian or the Chinese governments or any of those maybe sneaking in some kind of alterations to the text that you wrote?
Well, I know for a fact that that hasn't been done to the Chinese edition, because my wife is Chinese and she arranged the publication in Shanghai and in Beijing. And I arranged the one in Hong Kong. That was the first edition. It was serialized in the Hong Kong Economic Journal for the business intellectual community in Hong Kong. Oh. So it's not just a kid's book. People say, well, who are you writing this for? I said, well, people get it at different levels. And it was written and published in 1997, just at the turnover from Britain to China of Hong Kong. And they knew they were going to have to be a little more subtle in their criticism of the Chinese government. And so they serialized it in the Hong Kong Economic Journal. Well, I know that one was not tampered with, and my wife would have known if there was any tampering with the other editions. The only time that there was ever a request to modify it was in a Polish edition.
Hmm.
The guy who was funding the publication in Poland, he really liked the book, except he was nervous about one chapter, the chapter towards the end of the book that challenges questions about vice. And he said, could we leave that one out, that chapter out? And I said, oh, yeah, sure, okay. Since it's been put back in, but with later publication in a different by a different publisher. Hmm. But that's the only time that I'm aware of. For the Russian editions, it's possible that something is happening that I don't know about, but no one's informed me, and I don't have a Russian wife to tell me that's true.
Interesting. Thank you.
So you were working on this project in the 1980s before the sort of the fall of the Iron Curtain and the Berlin Wall. I'm kind of interested in this because I was born in Germany in 1989. Both of my parents were in the military, and they were able to go into the Eastern Bloc countries while they were there. So I've heard them tell stories about it. How much of the project, if any, was motivated by trying to spread these ideas to people in Eastern Bloc countries versus just trying to spread these ideas generally among the American population, who also needs to be sort of reintroduced to these ideas?
Well, precisely. You know, when I check the dates on this, it says this is the edition that was, these episodes were written between 1980 and 82, okay? And that's before the Soviet Union broke up and things came apart. But then I got very excited about this fall of the Iron Curtain and the breakup of the Soviet Union. And I joined Liberty International because I wanted to spread the ideas internationally, the libertarian ideas. And I, at the time, I didn't realize that my own book would be the biggest tool for doing that. But I was interested in spreading Rothbard and Friedman and Rand, all these guys around the planet. And Liberty International was a well-connected organization with good-hearted, libertarian-minded people in all these parts of the planet. And so they had conferences up in Sweden and in Tallinn, Estonia. And I went up there in Vilnius, Lithuania, with the hope of doing this. And when it was first published in Russia, I was so excited because I thought, wow, this is right after the fall of the Iron Curtain and the Cold War was finally over, and it took off throughout Eastern Europe. And I remember people, for example, this woman in Poland, she said, how long have you been living in Poland that you understood our issues and our problems so well? I said, I never lived in Poland. I was writing for Hawaii. But the issues of tyranny of government over people's lives is pervasive. When you write it in a sort of a neutral way, a story that doesn't know a specific date or location, then people can pull from it wherever they are. And that's why I think that it's a universal story.
Yeah, I agree with that. You talked earlier in your presentation about sort of the role of humor. But I think that's a big part of why your book is so effective. But also each chapter is written sort of like a parable or a story, and they're simple stories. They're encounters or ideas that any one of us encounter on a fairly frequent basis. And I think that the stories help sort of call into question a lot of the things that we hear in the media. A few stories come to mind, if you don't mind. Just for instance, the food police chapter, there's the story about the food police who are arresting this man for producing too much food. I remember I read this book when I was 8 or 9 years old, and I thought about this story when I was sitting in my law school class reading the case Wickard v. Filburn, which is a case about a man who was producing wheat and using the wheat to feed his own livestock. And the government said that, and the courts said that that was subject to the regulation under the Commerce Clause, because consuming his own wheat affected commerce and gave them the ability to regulate it. So I didn't realize that connection until later in life. But that was a story, nevertheless, that I remembered as a child, thinking, this happens. The government regulates this sort of activity and has no business regulating this sort of activity. So that's just one example. And there are many examples in your book of chapters that take on these issues in a simple way, in a way that people can remember because of the humor, because of the storytelling aspect of it. So I think that's why it made such a big impact on me.
Wickard versus Filburn just knocked me off my feet when I read about it. But I had also been already read, I mean, in my economics classes, I start off by talking about the government having the soil bank program, for example, that fined 14,000 farmers $8.5 million for the crime of producing too much food in the 1950s under the Eisenhower administration. And Ezra Taft Benson was the Secretary of Agriculture. And I remember pointing this stuff out to students, and they'd say, what? This isn't America. You know, the government can't do that. And yet this kind of stuff goes on all the time. But people accept it or shrug and say, that's, you can't do anything about it. You know, or that's the way it's always been. Or they don't know about it and don't care about it.
Yeah. Yeah. One question I'd like to ask is, the book's been updated and revised some over the years. Do you have any chapters in particular that are your favorite, or that you would point out to people as maybe some of the more important chapters in your book?
Yes. The ones that are the most catching, I think, is the one I put at the first, where they outlaw the hatchet because it knocks down trees efficiently and therefore threatens traditional jobs and employment. And people think, well, that's just absurd. But of course, that sort of thing is happening. People worry about computer technology. They worry about all kinds of changes that can jeopardize the way things have been traditionally done. I get some of my students say, oh, yeah, it was good to outlaw the hatchet because it saves trees. You know, and you think, well, but, you know, this is the logic of the Luddites and the ancient history. It's nothing new, but it still comes on to haunt us, the idea that new ideas are a threat to us. But another one is the toll tax. I think that people, this is the chapter where Jonathan encounters the first person he comes into in the city, where he's walking on his knees, not because he's crippled, but because the tax code will give him a tax break for being short. And then, I wrote that when I'm reflecting on how people shape their lives to the tax code. And the politicians, of course, have their reasons and motives, but who are they to be motivating people's lives? Nobody trusts the politicians as being honest and honorable and moral people. And yet they hand over this great authority to shape their lives with high taxes and low taxes to control the direction of their life. But another one is the Grand Inquirer, which is supposed to be a a parallel to Dostoevsky's The Grand Inquisitor, where he has this conversation, the Grand Inquisitor has this fictional conversation with Jesus, for example, about people wanting responsibility for their own lives. And basically, a point that is made is that people don't want responsibility for their lives. They're afraid of that, and they would rather turn over their responsibility to others. And that's something that we always need to fear. It's a very easy thing for people to just assume that government and government officials can take better care of their lives than they can. I mean, yeah, I like all the chapters, but those are some of the ones that are some highlights. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the story about the hatchet is particularly effective, because you hear that sort of mentality a lot in lots of different arenas when it comes to unions, either in the automotive industry or the teachers union, et cetera. Like it's this sort of protectionism of job, you know, of putting job security over sort of innovation and prosperity and improving the lives of individuals. Those sorts of arguments, I think, are pretty pervasive. And like you said, a lot of people, I think, might initially respond to your stories and say, well, those are absurd. But, and Aaron, you might chime in about this a little bit, but one effective tool can be to take their arguments to their logical sort of extremes or conclusions. And I think your stories do that to some degree, and sort of drive home the point by painting them in these sort of humorous and seemingly absurd ways at first, but not so absurd once you think about them a little bit.
Yeah, it's kind of like reductio ad absurdum arguments. You take a premise and take it to its logical conclusion, show it produces absurd results, and that sort of undermines the legitimacy of the premise itself. It's also kind of like a philosophical thought experiment as well. You create a kind of fictional scenario to isolate and illustrate a principle, and you do it in a pure form that enables you to examine it and decide whether or not it's an acceptable principle, and very often turns out not to be. And that's the utility of these kinds of things. People dismiss these things as nonsense, but they're not nonsense at all. These kinds of thought experiments are extremely valuable tools of thought. So this is a great thing. And the fact that it's accessible to children, because it's written, you know, and these are not complex stories. These are fairly simple things. They're accessible to children. Makes them absolutely wonderful, and that's why I gave it to Alex when he was a boy. And now look where look what's happened to him now.
Yeah,
that's right. What a good job he's done turning out like this.
Yeah. Well, thanks to Aaron and to Ken. My thought has fallen down the libertarian rabbit hole, and I'm either blessed with it or cursed with it. I'm not sure which.
Yeah, we've corrupted him, Ken.
Here I am. But and Aaron, you mentioned, you know, being accessible to children, and I think maybe this was during the part where you were having some technical difficulties, but Ken was talking about how, you know, this book isn't really tailored toward adults or children. You know, there are useful concepts in it. And I don't think you were suggesting that it's not still useful to adults.
Oh, no, it's a wonderful book. Yeah.
But that drives me to my next question, I think, is that, Ken, who has been the primary audience of your book? I know you didn't intend it for young children necessarily or for adults in particular, but what's your perception, or do you know who is the primary audience for your book?
I think of the primary audience as university college students who are just starting, or maybe high school students. But, I'd have to say, I mean, there are times, certain elements that were very good. For example, that case in Kazakhstan, they took the story of the tortoise and the hare. They have a competition to see who can deliver the most letters in 1 week. And the hare delivers all the mail very fast and very quick and very efficiently. And the tortoise just goes to the king and gets a letter patent to outlaw the competition. And so the tortoise wins the competition. And when that was presented as just a musical case in Kazakhstan to elementary schools, the kids were outraged. But that's not fair. And here, that's in the former Soviet Union talking about that's not fair for the government to outlaw competition. I thought that was fantastic. And the composer of it said, you know, Ken, can I change that just a little bit, the ending, because the kids are so upset with that. And I said, well, how do you want to change it? Well, have the hare decide then to deliver pizza instead of mail. And then the kids are at least happy because they're going to a free market concept. And I thought, well, great, fine.
That's great. And it's interesting that you mentioned that story from the book, because I recently did an episode about Lysander Spooner's Vices Are Not Crimes work. And of course, I'm sure you know, because of the tortoise and the hare story is similar to the plight of Lysander Spooner, who tried to start his own mail company and was driven out of business because of this sort of regulation.
That's why the hare is named Lysander.
There you go.
I don't know if you know it. And the tortoise is named Frank because he got his privilege by offering franking privileges to Congress. I mean, Congress gets to deliver their mail for free in exchange for a postal monopoly.
I should have remembered that his name was Lysander, but I think when I read the book initially, I didn't even know who Lysander Spooner was, and I didn't learn that until later. So that's great. And I noticed you use those names, Mises and Lysander and Hayek, throughout the book, sort of littered into the book here and there.
Yeah.
Well, I think Aaron, do you have any particular chapters that you like, or that you'd like to point out? I mentioned that there were a few, but
in my opinion, they are all gems. They really are. It's a marvelous, marvelous book. And I agree. And I didn't mean to imply that it's just for children. It's clearly not. I mean, it's accessible to children, but it's a wonderful book, even for old folks like me to read, actually. And all of the chapters are gems. I do like the hatchet story. I think that's a good one, because it's something that is so pervasive, and it comes up all the time. Even now we're seeing it. I've recently read a talk about controlling ChatGPT, because, you know, it's this new technology everybody's afraid of, and all this nonsense. So this kind of thing keeps coming up a lot. And so I think that's a very, very a good one to have in your toolkit that you can pull out at any moment. But that's one of my favorites. But they're all wonderful stories.
We need to regulate ChatGPT so lawyers can continue to have jobs.
That's exactly it. Yes, of course. Of course. Oh, I suspect that lawyers will find ways to have jobs. Don't worry. Yeah. No, we'll find ways of litigating.
Job security, by golly.
Yes, that's right. The Lawyer Full Employment Act.
Yes.
We're terrible.
Well, Ken, I'd like to ask you, I'll tell my story, I guess, a little bit about how I was led to libertarianism, and we've alluded to it a little bit, but I'd like to ask you that question about what led you to libertarians' philosophy and ideas. Obviously, for me, Aaron was friends with my father, and my dad had an interest in these sorts of ideas, but Aaron gave me your book when I was very young, and that sort of opened my mind to these sorts of ideas. And Aaron, of course, littered my bookshelf with Mises and Hayek at later dates. So that sort of early introduction, and then later, you know, that my mind was more receptive to these ideas. So that's really how, and then Ron Paul's campaign had a big impact on me and his views on foreign policy. But I guess I'd like you to talk a little bit about what led you to libertarian philosophy and ideas.
My earliest political memory, I'm so old that there was the Kennedy-Nixon debate in 1960. And I remember asking my mom, what's the difference between these two politicians? And she says, well, the Democratic politician says he wants the government to run your life, and the Republican politician wants individuals to run their own lives. And so I kind of got that vision in mind. Well, you either run your own life or run by government. Then, of course, later I found out that both parties wanted to run my life, just in different ways. that's why I discovered sort of the libertarian alternative, thinking, no, you really should be able to run your own life. But early influences along that line were Ayn Rand's Anthem early on, and then her other books, of course, and then Milton Friedman's columns and in Newsweek magazine, and his book Free to Choose and the Free to Choose series. The first real introduction to the libertarian philosophy was Murray Rothbard's For a New Liberty, and then Friedrich Bastiat's The Law. These books made a very, very profound impact on me and sent me off thinking on my own. Once I started, out of college, I started working in the government as an economist and was disgusted by that I was in everybody's way. As a bureaucrat, I wasn't doing anything productive. I was standing in people's way. So I left that and went into teaching up in Alaska. And that's where I explored the whole libertarian philosophy. Alaska is a great place for libertarian germination. And the rest was history, I guess you could say, after that. Yeah. Just those libertarian minds after that. And the Austrian school, it was a while before I really started teaching it. You know, I was teaching this traditional Keynesian and monetarist alternatives, but everything was Keynesian in most of the economics profession in the academic world. And now I think I'm probably the only Austrian economist in the Pacific region, but at any rate, at least the students are starting to get an alternative.
Well, that was going to be my next question. And Aaron, feel free to chime in here. I don't want to hog the airspace here, but people will certainly be interested in how you came to libertarian ideas, but I think they'll be more concerned with or interested in how you got to Hawaii. You've been a professor there for quite some time now. How did you end up in Hawaii?
I first left Washington, D.C. for Alaska, and I was teaching up in Alaska for 5 years. And it was a very, very small school, and a small town, too. And I ran into some quarrels with the local pulp mill that was getting massive subsidies from the Forest Service. And I thought, how much grief can I get in a small town, in a small school that was dependent on contributions from the pulp mill when I'm critical of that? So I looked around and I found a school in Hawaii that was willing to take me it was, again, a small school. I've been to a lot of small places, but I got to teach economics. And then, so I came to Hawaii that way.
Yeah. And you've been there for
1979 is when I first came to Hawaii.
Okay.
Taught in Japan for 2 years on exchange, but yeah, all this time has been Hawaii.
Are you aware of any students who attended the university there in Hawaii because they'd read your book?
Well, there are a couple actually. It's not the University of Hawaii; that's the government school. I teach only at private schools. This is Hawaii Pacific University, and yeah, I just. There's a very good friend of mine now. He lives in Montana on a ranch of his own. He said he was in the Navy, and he saw there was a bookshelf on board the Jonathan Gullible. He ran across that, and it said it changed his life. And then he came to Hawaii and started taking this class, and then realized, oh, that I was the same guy that had written that book, and we've been fast friends ever since. You know, it made a bit. I mean, there are. From time to time, these kinds of stories. And you, Alex, that was a godsend that you sent me this message the other day saying that this had a big impact on you. And I've posted it on my website, jonathangelbel.com, your story and photo, and that of Aaron, too.
Yeah, and I'll be sure to link to that, to your website and that story in the show notes to this episode. Because it's hard to overstate how it, your book sort of changed the trajectory of my thinking and my worldview. So I'm certainly thankful for that. Aaron, do you have anything you'd like to add or ask before we start to wrap up here in just a little bit? We're running up close on an hour. And I know, Ken, you're going to be doing some script writing to work on a cartoon that you're working on based on the book?
The cartoon series now, Jonathan Gullible cartoon series. It's going to be a three seasons, 8 episodes per season, with full animation, And you have no idea how complicated this is.
Aaron, anything you'd like to ask before we start to wrap up here?
I'm a little bit curious, you know, since you're a professor of economics and you say you're the only Keynesian on the West Coast, or non-Keynesian, I'm sorry, the only Austrian on the West Coast. Do you ever have any conflicts with your professional colleagues? Do they look at you like you're crazy, like you're the crazy Austrian economist in our department? Do you have any problems with that?
Yes, they always view me as the crazy Austrian economist, libertarian, and so on. Did I ever have any problems with it? No. They've all been very respectful. I think because I ran for public office as a libertarian before I was hired. So there was no hiding my position, nothing to reveal. I had already revealed everything about me. I was just very, very fortunate to be hired by a guy who was, he wasn't libertarian himself, but his son was, real hardcore libertarian, and he was respectful of my position. And the president of the college at the time was also, he told me, I agree with everything except maybe foreign policy or something. You know, there'd always be a slight exception.
Sure.
They all appreciated my position. And so I've always been viewed as sort of the odd guy in the room, but but it's never, I've never felt it was negative. They never did me injury because of that. Anyway,
that's good. That's very good to hear. Do you have any indication that maybe you've converted any of them or opened their minds a little bit?
I converted. No, and none of them have become libertarians. I'd have to say my best thing is that occasionally I have some students who pop up. Per Bielan, former student from Sweden.
Oh, right. Yeah.
He was in my classes way back in the early 90s. Now, you know, he writes regularly at the Mises Institute. He's on the board of directors at the Liberty International, professor of economics and entrepreneurship at Oklahoma State University. I mean, okay, some of these guys will still take jobs with government universities, but
yeah,
okay. But anyway, yeah, he's one great.
I have some of his books. Actually, I had no idea he was your student.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
All right.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, I'll ask this just to follow up to Aaron's question: have any of your colleagues read your book? You said they hadn't been converted. Have they actually read your book? And if so, have they tried to grapple with the ideas in your book at all, or have any discussions with you about, hey, you're wrong about this, or this is why we don't agree with you? Have you had any discussions like that with your colleagues?
No, I think none of them have read it. I think they view it as sort of a pariah, you know, something you hold up like you're holding up the Satan's symbol or something like that. I don't think they've read it. Don't give it any credibility. I mean, I pointed out all of these books are the Jonathan Gullible books from Italy, from Georgia, from this is, I think, the Czech Republic. I mean, from all over the world. And yet they don't give it much credibility. I think they think they're all self-published. And to be totally honest, all of them, I didn't even ask people to publish them. They came to me, maybe because of my connection with Liberty International, they found out about it, but they all came to me and said, I'd like to publish it. And I let them publish it. I don't take any of the revenues from it. People say I'm crazy to do that, but I want to encourage it. They've all published it all around the world in 57 languages. So to me, that's the great tribute. That's the reward. And I'm glad to have them do that. But my students sometimes will say, oh, you use this in the classroom. And it's kind of, at the beginning of the course, they say it's kind of nasty of you to require us to teach, to read your book. I say, well, you don't have to buy it. You can get it free online at my Jonathan Gullible website. And then they all say afterwards, oh, that was the most fun reading. Nobody likes the textbook. Everybody likes this thing. I've never had any bad response from the students. I have one philosophy professor that I have a very good relationship with. He considers himself a radical progressive, and he's constantly telling me he has terrible disagreements with me, but I keep telling him, actually, I think the things you're trying to accomplish in the world, if you really want to accomplish these things, you'll find them much more likely through free markets than through your governmental controls. And so we get into the conversation every now and then, but it's friendly. He's invited me to speak to his class and on political philosophy. So I'd say that's a good relationship.
Oh, excellent. I'd like to point out too here, we discussed this a little bit earlier about who the audience is, but I told my wife that I would tell you thank you because she has been reading this book in anticipation of listening to this episode, and she loves your book. I think she was surprised at how much she loved it, and she said, it's amazing to me that I went through high school and 12 years of secondary education and college and grad school, and I was never introduced to these ideas. And this is the book that it took to convey these concepts to me. So thank you from her and from me as well.
When I hear something like that, please tell her that if she'll send me her photo and her testimony, I'll post it on the Jonathan Gelbo website. I just did from two women in Afghanistan who said that the same thing happened to them. And I'm delighted to put it up. So, okay, Afghanistan, that's no problem. But Indiana, now that's a serious issue. So,
exactly. It is indeed. Well, her portrait would look much better than the mugshot from either me or Aaron.
Yeah, so. I agree. No question.
If your goal is to get traffic to your website, it's certainly better to have her picture.
Well, put the three of you together in that picture, and then I'll post it.
Yeah, there we go. We'll have to do that. We occasionally meet up for dinner. We'll have to do that.
Yeah.
Well, we're over a little bit over an hour now. Ken, you want to say anything just in closing? I appreciate you being on the show, and it was great to chat with you, and thank you for your presentation. But if you would, I'd like to give you a few last words.
Sure. Thank you, Alex. I'm so grateful for this opportunity to talk and to meet you and Aaron. And I really appreciate the fact that you've valued this book, and I mean, it makes decades of work feel all worthwhile. Mm-hmm. And I hope we're making a better world from this. I mean, we see individuals that are affected by our pushing of free markets, and you'll find people throughout time that forge a freedom. What you're doing, they will come back to you later and say, thank you, Alex. I got onto these ideas because of you. And it spreads. Hopefully, we just have to. I think I'm always remindful of that phrase over the National Archives that says, liberty is the eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. And I think that's what we need to constantly aware of and keep pushing no matter what.
Yeah. Well, you certainly inspired me. I don't think it's a stretch to say that the Forge of Freedom may not exist today without me having read your book. So, so thank you for that, and thank you, Aaron. On the record, I'll thank Aaron.
For sharing his ideas.
When this is posted, let me know. I'll post the link of this show on the website and all too. Thanks.
Excellent. Well, thank you for that. And I think in close, I'd like to share. This is a review that I found on Goodreads, and I'm curious, you mentioned a student that you'd had from, who's living in Montana now. Is his name Mike by chance?
Mike's
review?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, this is his review. I'd like to read a few excerpts from his review on Goodreads just to sort of close up, if that's okay.
Good.
So to say that the adventures of Jonathan Gullible is different from other economics or libertarian books would be a gross understatement. The book is written as a series of parables following the travels of a young man named Jonathan Gullible, stranded on the strange island of Karumpo, This island serves as a setting for a thrashing of every commonly accepted fallacy of government and economics. Ken's book is masterful in its ability to deliver profound logic in language and analogy that a small child could understand. The book is equal parts Gulliver's Travels and Economics in One Lesson. Instead of giving my friends For a New Liberty or Human Action, which they probably won't read, I give them The Adventures of Jonathan Gullible. I strongly believe that even the most stalwart non-libertarians who read this book from cover to cover will find their worldview resting a little less comfortably than before. The book is available in over 40 languages, and in my humble opinion, no libertarian's bookshelf is complete without it. My copy rests happily between Man, Economy, and State and The Road to Serfdom. Between such great books, the Adventures of Jonathan Gullible stands proud and deserving, because without it, I would have never read all the rest. I think you'll find this book has powerful lessons that will stick with you, much like they did for me, and this is me, not Mike anymore, much like they stuck with me for over 20 years. So thanks again, Mr. Schooland, and thanks, Aaron, for joining the show.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm going to go visit Mike this summer, and I want to post that on my website too. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
Yep. Thank you. All right. Thanks to everyone for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed the show. If you did enjoy the show, don't forget to give it a thumbs up and subscribe to help spread the message of freedom. Tomorrow for Monday Gun Day, I'll have my father back in the studio, Mike Uli, to discuss Jeff Cooper's combat triad. And we'll also provide a brief update with respect to the ATF final rule on pistol stabilizing braces. Until then, remember, you are the Forge of Freedom.